Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this program, we spend the hour examining Brexit, what the election of Boris Johnson means for Brexit, and a bitterly polarized British public and politics. Is a Brexit deal possible? Doug Becker moderates.
I am Doug Becker. On June 23rd, 2016, British voters chose to leave the European Union by a 52-48% vote. This decision is popularly known as Brexit. In the next 3 years, Great Britain has attempted to negotiate their withdrawal from the EU, but to very little progress. Prime Minister Theresa May resigned from office on June 7th as a result of these political failures, and the Conservative Tory Party chose Boris Johnson to replace her as Prime Minister. In today's Scholar Circle, we will explore the future of Brexit in light of the assumption of Boris Johnson to the Prime Minister position and the future of British politics. Our panelists today are Paul Craig. He is currently Professor of English Law at the University of Oxford and a Fellow of St. John's College. He is the author of Britain Alone, The Implications and Consequences of United Kingdom Exit from the EU. Russell Foster is an early career fellow at the Department of European and International Studies at King's College London. He is author of Cry God for Harry, England, and St. George, Europe, and the Limits of Integrating Identity. And Simon Radford is an independent scholar based in the United Kingdom. He is co-author of Can Donations Buy You a British Peerage? A Study in the Link Between Party, Political Funding, and Peerage Nominations, 2005 to 2014. Paul Craig, Theresa May was not able to negotiate an agreement acceptable to both the EU and to members of her own government. Why has it been so difficult to get an agreement?
Well, I think there are kind of multiple factors. But the bottom line is actually the sticking point, whether it should have been a sticking point or not, but the principal sticking point, which has prevented Theresa May getting her deal through Parliament, the principal sticking point has been the Northern Ireland backstop. Now, the Northern Ireland backstop can be simple or complicated. It depends how you approach it. The bottom line with the Northern Ireland backstop is actually rather fundamental. You need the backstop for the following reasons. Economic and peace. In Northern Ireland, you have an open border at present between ERA, the Republic of Ireland, and Northern Ireland. The big fear is if the UK leaves, then that border will become a hard border. And that will be very prejudicial to peace between the two islands and very prejudicial to trade. So what they devised in the withdrawal agreement is something called the Northern Ireland backstop. The rationale behind it was to keep an open border between the two islands until a trade deal could be structured between the UK and the EU in order to obviate the need for that Northern Ireland backstop. Now, that didn't please many of the hardline Brexiteers in the European Research Group, who argued, I believe quite wrongly, that the EU was indirectly or directly bent on keeping the UK forever in a customs union. That is not true. That, I think, is mistaken. Look at it from the perspective of the EU. From the perspective of the EU, in a post-Brexit world, the Northern Ireland border is an external border for the whole of the EU. So goods can come into the EU over that border and into ERA, and then they have free movement in relation to the rest of Europe. Although much of the attention with the Northern Ireland backstop has been focused on the customs part, actually the EU is much more really concerned, or just as much concerned, with product safety. The way I always convey it is, what they're worried about is whether your child's teddy bear, which comes from a third country and ends up in the EU, coming over this open border, is actually going to comply and be safe in accordance with EU product safety rules. So I think the idea that the Northern Ireland backstop is some sort of Machiavellian plan by the EU to keep the UK in a customs union and tied to the EU forever and a day is mistaken. But that's the view which has been taken by the hard right within the Tory party. And let's be clear, they've had an agenda of their own, and their agenda has always been they want to push for a no-deal Brexit. So they saw opposition to the withdrawal agreement as a way in which to tilt the balance of power towards no deal, which is what they're getting.
Russell Foster, on this sort of same issue, with this interest, a no-deal Brexit, is the ideal here in particular for the core of the Leave, you know, the Leave coalition, to just break completely with the EU? And this is an example of Britain sort of turning its back on the continent and looking someplace else?
Well, the British have always been maybe the most reluctant member of the European Union. So when we joined the European Economic Community in 1973, almost immediately there were concerns around this. And because of the general political chaos in 1974, a referendum had to be held as to whether we should even stay in the EEC less than 2 years after we joined it. And since the early 1970s, as I say, we've always been reluctant. A bit like the guest at a party who doesn't really want to be there, but they'll be there for diplomatic purposes. There's always been quite a strong Euroscepticism among British politicians, both on the right and the left. We can't forget that the very hard left are equally opposed to the European Union. But this sort of Euroscepticism was quite marginal. It was vocal, but it was marginal until the early 2000s and the Brexit vote in 2016, my research is arguing, was not really a vote against the European Union. I mean, of course, it was the core issue. But we have to remember that by 2016, when the referendum was held, this was 8 years into a period of austerity. This was in a period of increasing disillusionment with the general system of British politics. And this was riding on the back of very emotional politics that were released at the time of the 2014 Scottish referendum. So when the 2016 referendum was held, yes, it did tap into and reflect a long-term Euroscepticism among the British, but to a great extent, it was a vote not against the European Union, it was a vote against the Conservative Party, it was a vote against David Cameron, the then Prime Minister, it was a vote against austerity, it was a vote against a general system, a system which for millions of British people has forgotten about them. Britain is one of the most centralised in the Western world. And in the last 30, 40 years, we've seen the capital city, London, having an extremely disproportionate say over British politics, over British media, over British culture. And in 2016, when the referendum was held, whereby every vote counted, people used this as an opportunity to express their despair, their anger, their contempt for the general system. Let's not forget that during the Brexit campaign, it was almost taken as a given that the result would be Remain, that whatever emotions were released in the campaign would quickly die down again. And when the country woke up on the Friday morning to the news that Leave had won, it was quite a shock because, as I say, people didn't really expect it to happen. But in the 3 years since the Brexit referendum, emotions have become much, much more heightened, much more vicious. And the European Union has ended up becoming, if you like, a bogeyman for so many issues which are not really related to the European Union. So the referendum was born out of a very wide variety of concerns. As Professor Paul Craig just said, there were multiple factors. There were all sorts of reasons that people voted Leave in 2016. But in the last 3 years since the referendum, emotions have split and become much, much more polarized to the point that people who voted differently to you are now seen as not only wrong, but consciously wrong, as malevolent, as almost evil in a way. So the political and emotional situation has become much, much more polarized. And this makes it extremely difficult for either side, Leave or Remain, or for any party or politician to put forward a proposal, a solution, which doesn't end up seriously angering a very, very large portion of the British population.
Simon Radford, Russell Foster has described a bitter polarization within British politics as a result of the Brexit debates and the post-Brexit issues. Now, into this breach then steps Boris Johnson, one of the most polarizing figures in British political history. How did he become prime minister, and is he likely to further polarize the nation or to possibly unite it?
I think in terms of finding out the origins of Boris Johnson depends on how far back you want to go. So there has been plenty of op-eds and ink spilled by journalists going back to his time at Oxford, even to school at Eton, one of a school that's produced now 20 British prime ministers, which is quite an extraordinary number. There's been a darn sight more Etonian prime ministers than there have been Labour prime ministers, and it's kind of hard sometimes to wrap one's head around that. But it's clear it's been a job that he's wanted since he was practically a boy. It's something he's been working for ever since. And I think that is resting on two pillars. The first is a sense of Boris's charisma and electability. And the second, based on his leave credentials with the Tory party members. The Tory party members are very scared of a Jeremy Corbyn prime ministership. They are worried that they are losing their ability to win elections as their voting base gets increasingly older. In some ways, there's an acknowledgement that there is a crisis in conservatism, even as the other parties have to face their own challenges. And the way that they think that they can address this is by having a charismatic leader who can reach parts of the country which traditionally the Conservatives have not been able to do, and by having someone who, at the same time, quote unquote, won't betray them. The vast majority of the Tory grassroots are very much in the Leave and very much in the hard Brexit camp. So Boris, because of his, and it's interesting that we refer to him as Boris and everyone knows who we mean, Mr. Johnson, who played such a very, very prominent role leading the Vote Leave campaign, has that credibility with the Tory grassroots, but he's also considered charismatic and an ability to convince others to their banner in a way that some of the more interesting characters on the Tory right might just be kind of preaching to the choir and not have the ability to reach beyond the Conservatives' natural base. One of the interesting things about the Vote Leave campaign is that it was highest in many ways in traditional Labour heartlands, in places which had suffered the most from deindustrialization under Thatcher, and places which had, in fact, a kind of antipathy to the Conservative Party. At the last election, there was some thought that the Conservatives might make inroads in these sort of areas and pick up some seats, specifically in the Northeast. But Boris Johnson is seen as someone who might be able to help traditional Labour voters that jump to the Conservative Party, possibly through the gateway drug of voting for the Brexit Party first. But if they're going to vote for the Brexit Party first, they need to vote for a Conservative Party who they think truly believe in Brexit. And that's what Boris's brand is.
I'd like to take a moment to apologize for some of the sound issues that we're experiencing. We are working on this. Part of the picture I'm getting here is that there seems to be vested interests in ensuring that there was no deal on Brexit. Paul Craig, was Theresa May's desire for a deal a bit of an illusion, and that a deal probably was never really possible?
One needs to step back a bit to shortly after the result of the referendum. And there's been a fault line running through British politics since then, which no one has ever really owned up to. Because actually, the bottom line is, in purely numerical terms, the number of hard Brexiteers who really want a New Deal Brexit, numerically rather limited within the Tory party, probably somewhere in the region of 80, not probably three figures even. One of the interesting stories which a political scientist is going to write at some stage is how the hard Brexiteers have continually punched above their weight. They operate with a Praetorian Guard zeal, and they've continually punched above their weight even before the referendum. So everything that the coalition government under David Cameron did in relation to the EU was almost always explicable as a result of pressure being put on Cameron by the numerically limited but nonetheless very effective hard Brexiteers. Indeed, the very promise he made in the Bloomberg speech to hold the referendum was as a result of that kind of pressure. Now, I think if you then fast forward from there, from Bloomberg in 2013 to after the referendum, what you actually had was something which the governing class didn't really want to own up to, which was actually a very simple tension. And it was a simple tension which is easily expressed between a soft Brexit and a hard Brexit. The bottom line is, if you have a soft Brexit entails some continuing close ties with the EU, either in the form of something akin to what's known as the European Economic Area, plus a customs union, the sort of deal that Norway has. The bottom line there is, if you have a soft Brexit, then you minimize the economic hardship or harm caused by Brexit. But at the same time, what that entails is the point that you made in your very introduction to this program. What that entails is you are bound by the regulations and have no voice at the table. And actually, part of the problem with a soft Brexit is very difficult, really, to think of arguments why a soft Brexit is better than being in the EU. Because if you're going to be bound by the single market rules and the customs union rules, but you don't have a voice at the table, then it's quite difficult to think of why that's a better world than being in the EU, which is the kind of reasoning of a lot of Remainers. On the other side of the scale, a no-deal Brexit, no matter what the hardline Brexiteers say, the predominant view, and I think correctly, of most economists, is that a no-deal Brexit will have a pretty cataclysmic effect on the UK economy, and not just necessarily in the short term, but in the medium to long term. Economists tend to think that a no-deal Brexit would make an economic hit to the country of somewhere between 8 and 12% of GDP. That is enormous. That is enormous in terms of jobs. One of the tragedies of Brexit is that many of those people in Labour heartlands who voted to leave, they will be the people who are affected when their jobs are lost, when the inward investment dries up, when car plants move their production to the continent. Those are the people who are going to be hurt. So this kind of rock and a hard place between soft Brexit on the one hand and a no-deal Brexit has been there from the very beginning. And one of the tragedies politically about Brexit was that division and choice should have been explained to the voters before the referendum, or at the very least after the referendum and before we triggered notification to leave the EU via Article 50. But it didn't happen.
You are listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We are discussing Brexit in light of Boris Johnson's assumption to the Prime Minister position with Paul Craig of the University of Oxford, Russell Foster of King's College London, and Simon Radford, an independent scholar based in the United Kingdom.
I'm reminded the observation about the soft Brexit that might put the UK in the same position as, say, Norway, with the ties to the EU, but not necessarily being at the table to negotiate that, the old line negotiations that if you're not at the table, you're most likely on the menu. And so how much those fears being tied to the EU, but not having a voice has always, I mean, it's always struck me as being perhaps the most suboptimal outcome. But regardless,
Could I just add one point there? Sorry, I did just add one point. I think you're right. I think that the metaphor, if you're not at the table, you're on the menu. I think it's a real it's a metaphor which has bite, if you like, if I could extend the metaphor. But equally, there's a further twist to this, because one of the paradoxes of this is that even if we end up with a hard Brexit, actually, the government will then be scrambling, no matter what it says, it will be scrambling to maintain as many ties as it can with the EU in order to minimize the damage to the British economy. So what's going to happen is that even if you have a no-deal Brexit, because we're very much an 80% service economy and we're so dependent upon the City of London, financial services, banking, all of that, what's going to happen is that in order to minimise at least the flight of bankers from London to Amsterdam and Frankfurt and all those places, our rules about financial regulation and banking regulation continue to track those of the EU. So the bottom line is that even in a no-deal Brexit world, you'll still end up being a rule follower and not a rule maker, and you'll still be ending up, in effect, bound by rules where you're not at the table.
I'd like to take a moment to apologize for some of the sound issues that we're experiencing. We are working on this. Russell Foster, the potential economic pains of the Leave vote were part of the pre-vote campaigns. It isn't as though these economic challenges of leaving weren't known at the time of the vote, but the British people seem to have a legacy of fighting through these difficult economic times, of the slogan, keep calm and carry on when times are difficult, that we the British will fight through austerity and things will get better. Does this explain the lack of concern for economic hardship among the Leave voters?
Well, this is certainly something that that exists in British discourse today. I mean, for the last 3 years, it's possible to live in this country a single day without encountering someone talking about Brexit on the TV, on the radio, reading about it in the newspapers. And there has been a lot of this sort of sentiment of, you know, where the British, we saw off Philip of Spain, Napoleon Bonaparte, the Kaiser, Hitler, all of this, and we can pull through this. This is something which has only appeared since the vote. At the time of the referendum, this was almost non-existent. This historical memory just didn't factor into discussions of leave or remain. It's something which has come about subsequently. And this is because for both sides, really, for leave and for remain, the mechanics and the details of Brexit, the economic side of it, have become less relevant to people than the emotional side of it, and the resurgence of all sorts of different forms of nationalism. There's a lot of discussion that we are, well, a very, very badly divided country and a seriously split society, and that we've got two groups of people who now view the other as anathema, as the enemy. The old divides between Labour and Conservative that Simon Redford was talking about, they've largely become irrelevant. The defining divide in British politics now is leave or remain. And the economic arguments, which were certainly well discussed in the build-up of the referendum, which have been discussed constantly for the last 3 years, have, for millions of people, have become much less significant than the emotional side of it. What this points to is that the biggest problems in British politics now are a complete lack of faith in the system. And this is found among Remainers, among Leavers, among all four members of the United Kingdom. A very low faith that the system represents people, a great sense of betrayal by Remainers and by Leavers, and a sense that the nation is something to rally around. And we're seeing this on both sides. Among Leavers, we've got appeals to British nationalism and the resurgence of English nationalism, which is something that was, I won't say repressed for the last few decades, but it was much less visible than, say, a Welsh or Northern Irish nationalism. So we're getting nationalist arguments from Leavers, but we're getting the exact same nationalist arguments from a lot of Remainers who have built up European identity into something which is imagined to be perfect and something which is the ostensible solution to all of our problems. So we've got two sides, both appealing to an imaginary nation, both appealing to a historical memory. Remember that European identity was not really something that was discussed in British politics until the referendum was called. In the last few years, we've seen scenes on the television and in the streets where we've got people painting their faces in the European flag and, you know, marching on Parliament, shouting, never going to give you up, this sort of thing. We would never have seen that kind of sentiment before 2016, but it has emerged in the last 3 years as a nationalist rallying point in contrast to the traditional British originalisms that existed beforehand. And that's why it is absolutely impossible. It's a really pessimistic analysis, but I think it's absolutely impossible for any government, any party, and any politician to satisfy the British nation with any form of Brexit. A soft Brexit along the lines of Theresa May's deal will end up dissatisfying everyone. A hard Brexit will satisfy some, but will alienate the other half. And simply revoking Article 50 and saying we're not going to have any Brexit will satisfy half of the Remainers, who are this country's population, but alienate the Leavers. So there's really not a satisfactory solution. And let's not forget that it's now early August 2019. We've already had one extension to the Brexit deadline, to the 31st of October. It's quite unlikely that the EU is going to be in any mood to grant us another extension. And people like Emmanuel Macron are already making very public overtures that, frankly, they want the British to go, because we've always been a break on the European project. So simply by the calendar, it seems that the default position is going to be no Brexit, because there is no way to negotiate a new deal short of some sort of miracle and a change of heart in Brussels. So no matter what happens, it's going to alienate at least half of the British population, because, as I say, this has come down not to rational, economic or constitutional arguments, but to a sense of people wanting belonging, people that their voices are heard. And so it's about emotion. Emotion is not something which can be legislated.
What strikes me is that the vote on Brexit was really very close. And you know, even recent polls suggest that the polls would remain close. Remain may win a new vote, but it wouldn't be by any more than a couple of points. But the political parties don't seem to reflect these two hardened and polarized positions. There's leavers and remainers in the Tories and leavers and remainers in the Labour Party. Simon Radford, it appears this is a wonderful opportunity for political realignment. Is there an opening for a realignment of the political parties that might, you know, reflect the actual division of British voters? Within, say, 5 years, could new or reconstituted parties create a new party alignment for the country?
If we can all agree on one thing in British politics over the last few years, is that people making brave predictions about the future tend to look very foolish shortly thereafter. So I won't say for sure that there's definitely going to be a realignment. I mean, I think we've had false dawns so many times on that before. Recently, we had some people leave the Labour Party to form a party called Change UK. Many people were drawing analogies back to the last time people left the Labour Party for seemingly being out of step with their values, which was the Social Democratic Party in the 1980s. They used to talk about breaking the mould of British politics, but the British political mould is made of pretty firm stuff, and it's largely done so because it's based on the first-past-the-post voting system. I think one of the things we've seen with different elections based on different voting methods is that there are opportunities for people to vote Lib Dem or people to vote for the Brexit Party or what have you, in order to essentially take a holiday from reluctantly voting for, quote-unquote, their regular party. So last time we had the European elections before the ones just gone, UKIP did tremendously well, which I guess one could call the forerunner of the Brexit Party. However, the subsequent general election, they very much didn't repeat their form and people came back to the Conservative Party. I think what's interesting, perhaps, is what it might mean in terms of what it happens at the margin. So rather than maybe Jo Swinson, the newly elected leader of the Liberal Democrats, thinking that she might vault into number 10, what she's got a very good potential of doing is bleeding votes from a Labour Party which doesn't particularly convince either Remainers or Leavers, perhaps keep Boris Johnson in number 10. What the Brexit Party will equally be trying to do is casting Boris as a sellout to the Leave cause and might well be taking votes away from the Conservative Party, which might inadvertently put Jeremy Corbyn in number 10. So what you have is, you know, three-dimensional chess to a certain extent, and perhaps the one thing that holds it together is this negative partisanship. Brexit Party voters dislike not many more people than Jeremy Corbyn. Most Remainers can't think of most people who make their skin crawl more than Boris Johnson. Jeremy Corbyn has to bet that people who might flirt with the Liberal Democrats will come home to the Labour Party. And Boris will be hoping the same thing, that the Brexit Party voters will eventually win and put their cross next to the Conservative Party candidate, because the threat of a Remain cosmopolitan pseudo-Marxist, or however they're going to coin Jeremy Corbyn, it's going to be enough to keep them voting for Boris Johnson. So what's interesting is the fact that we've got kind of these parties taking votes from the two main parties, and it scrambled all the electoral arithmetic. There's a very good possibility that whoever's the next prime minister, they'll be leading a party which gets a very, very low vote share.
When we come back, we discuss the rise of Boris Johnson, the future of the British economy, and what the UK will likely look like in 2024. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about the future and possibility of Brexit with the rise of Boris Johnson. What will happen to the British economy? What will the UK look like in 2024? Doug Becker moderates.
I am Doug Becker. Our panelists today are Paul Craig of the University of Oxford, Russell Foster of King's College London, and Simon Radford, an independent scholar based in the United Kingdom. Paul Craig, a post-Brexit UK would likely need to negotiate a trade deal with the United States to replace some of its trade with its current EU partners. What can the UK expect in these negotiations on a trade deal with the United States?
So I think there's no doubt that the UK will seek trade deals with other countries, including the US, including India, Japan, other big trading countries, the BRICS countries, Brazil, etc. And it will be able to do so autonomously in its own right, won't have to ask anybody's permission. So all of that's a plus. There's no doubt that the first port of call for trade talks, or one of the first ports of call, will be trade talks with the US. The US President Trump has already given positive vibes in that respect, welcomed Boris Johnson as Prime Minister, and shown that he is willing to open the door to trade talks with the UK. But I think there are two cautionary notes to bear in mind in this respect. One, in pure quantitative economic terms, there's no doubt that trade with the EU in quantitative terms is more important than trade with the US. And it's difficult to see how a diminution in trade with the EU would necessarily be made up by an increase in trade with the US. Equally important, perhaps more important, is the fact that when it comes down to it, trade talks tend to be pretty much hardball talks. And they're hardball talks even between friends. And President Trump has already made clear that if there are trade talks and a trade deal between the UK and the US, then, in his words, or something like his words, pretty much everything has to be on the table, including possible opening up of markets, including the NHS, including UK financial markets, to the relevant firms from the US. So the idea that we're going to walk away from any trade deal with the US, who is a much more powerful, which is a much more powerful trading country than the UK, the idea that we're going to walk away with some sweetheart deal is, I think, very unlikely.
One issue that dominated the Brexit debate was the presence of a large immigrant labor population in the UK, as well as the Schengen Agreement enabling the free flow of labor within the EU. Russell Foster, how important was the reaction to a large immigrant, largely non-white population in the UK? And what can you imagine is the post-Brexit scenario for this population and sort of generally about British immigration policy?
Well, as I say, there were a lot of factors. There was about 17 million people voted for Brexit, and so theoretically there's 17 million different reasons for it. And of course, one of those reasons was a concern over high levels of immigration. It's uncomfortable to talk about, but of course there is a widespread concern in British society that immigration has become too high. Now, this is not purely a far-right white nationalist xenophobia or racism towards people. There are legitimate queries about whether large levels of immigration are driving down wages, whether it's the housing shortage that we already have in this country and on what is frankly a crumbling infrastructure. So there were these rational arguments against it. In terms of what might be called irrational or more emotional objections to immigration, we should split these into two: of concerns about immigration from other EU countries and immigration from outside the EU. Now, a few years ago, must be pointed out that Britain is not a member of the Schengen zone. And a few years ago, there were widespread concerns, large numbers of the British population, about Eastern European migrants who, when countries like Romania, Bulgaria, Poland joined the European Union and then had access to the Schengen accords and could move across the EU, there were concerns that Britain was, in their language, being invaded or being flooded by cheap labour and by foreigners. This is something which is possibly going to be affected by the Brexit deal. That's something I'll come to in a moment. But a much wider concern is about non-European immigration into the country, and specifically immigration from Islamic countries and the Middle East. That is probably not going to be affected in any way by Brexit. In fact, it might actually increase after Brexit, because obviously the Islamic world is not part of the European Union. Now, in the immediate aftermath of Brexit, there was a great discussion in British politics that there would be an exodus, basically an evacuation of EU citizens from Brexit Britain, of going back to EU countries. Now, immigration levels from the EU have fallen, and of course we have seen small numbers going back, but the claims of a mass exodus or of a collapse in EU immigration haven't happened. So immigration was a factor in the Brexit vote. It is still a factor today. Otherwise, we wouldn't have Boris Johnson, Theresa May, Jeremy Corbyn constantly talking about immigration. But as I say, there were many, many different factors. Now, in the very likely event that we do get a hard Brexit, it will almost certainly lead to a further reduction in EU immigration into the country. But a concern is that in order to make up the shortfall, it will lead to an increase of immigration from non-EU countries, which for many people is precisely what Britain was in 2000. But as I say, I must stress that there were many, many different factors for voting for Leave. And one serious problem that has emerged in this country in the last 3 years is, to go back to what I was saying earlier about how Remainers and Leavers now frankly demonize one another. One problem we've had is that in the last 3 years, we've seen a very, very vocal group of Remainers who do not represent all Remainers, of course, but a very vocal group of Remainers who say that anyone who voted Leave is obviously a racist. That is clearly not true and clearly not the case. Immigration has been weaponized by both sides, by both Leave and Remain, and has led to an even greater split. It's effectively two nations living within the same country, a nation of Leavers and a nation of Remainers, who view each other as the enemy, and both of whom have picked up on immigration and on multiculturalism as a way to demonize everyone who has a different opinion to them.
What has brought this Brexit very much to the forefront here in the United States was the rise of Boris Johnson. And I know that a number of Americans have described Johnson as sort of the British Donald Trump. Simon Radford, how accurate is that? What are the similarities and differences between Boris Johnson and the American president?
Again, it's kind of funny to say, you know, is someone like Donald Trump? I mean, I think for better or worse, he's quite unique. But there's certainly sort of some similarities which one can quite easily draw. I mean, Boris Johnson has a history of using racial and racialized language for political gain. He described black British people as pickaninnies. He's made very casual and derogatory language about people who wear traditional Islamic dress. He's also taken on people from Liverpool in the wake of a tragedy which afflicted that city. He's quite happy to play divide and rule politics in a way that Donald Trump has, and in a way that is hidden behind a hint of a smile or some humor, so that when people take it seriously, they can be seen as being, you know, too PC or not getting with the joke. And in that way, he's always been able to hint to the right that he understands their concerns at these issues, all the while being a mayor of London and a resident of what was called the Notting Hill set, which is a kind of a cosmopolitan enclave of London, who can also be seen as a kind of a liberal Boris Johnson, as one who, you know, is at home in a cosmopolitan city in London. And so just like Donald Trump can say things about guns and trade and other things that might, you know, sort of perhaps make him out to not be a typical Republican, equally he's happy to perhaps nudge and hint at these kind of darker sides of things that very much play to the far right base. So in that sense, he's quite an adept political figure at playing on these different notes and these different emotions, and frankly not letting substance get in the way of these rather brighter, more primary colors that he paints with. And I think that's a primary appeal. I think the fact that he's also not your typical politician from central casting at a time when politicians, frankly, are in disrepute is very much a thing which plays in his favor. I mean, I think both of our guests have said that there's a kind of anti-elite reaction and anti-politics is normal reaction, which has powered a lot of Brexit. I mean, I think you can say that it goes back before that, too. We used to have complaints when Tony Blair was prime minister about the spin culture in Downing Street. I think the one thing which we haven't brought up today, which I think plays a huge role in this, is the financial crisis and what that's meant for people's trust in institutions, as well as the economic repercussions. And there's a kind of an interesting hypothetical, which is, would we have had Brexit if we hadn't had the financial crisis? And clearly that, I think, poured salts on some wounds which were already there from back in the days from under Thatcher, where people feel like they were in places which were quite forgotten. And in that sense, people are quite happy to be entertained if they don't feel like they're being listened to. And Boris Johnson's a politician who, like him or loathe him, people don't seem to be able to take their eyes off him. And that's something which he's used to great effect throughout his political career. He's been able to always kind of barge his slightly more grey colleagues off the center stage and captured the kind of limelight for himself. One of his old friends, and in the way that aspiring Tory politicians are friends with each other and also are quite happy to compete and stab each other in the back, is a guy called Michael Gove, who was the perhaps more slightly substantial leader of the Vote Leave campaign. You know, he's been kind of nudged aside at every turn by Boris Johnson, simply on the basis of Boris Johnson essentially is more fun to listen to than Michael Gove. So there's an element, I think, of both the celebrity, of both the ability to not take politics too seriously and use entertainment, and perhaps that ability to play and realize that politics is at heart emotional rather than rational, and that he can activate certain feelings and certain emotions by essentially drawing from quite a wide palette when it comes to that, whether he wants to duck towards the more cosmopolitan side or weave towards the more narrow nationalist side. He's quite adept that way, and probably a bit like Trump, finally, it's easy, I think, for people to have underestimated both of them as quite skilled political operators. There's been some quite interesting reportage from behind the scenes from reporters like Robert Peston saying that they've done charity functions with Boris Johnson, and the person who you see with the mussed-up hair and the halting manner of speech is actually quite a smooth, calculating, considered, and fluent person behind closed doors. And I'm not saying that Boris Johnson is necessarily like Byron when you close the door, but he is someone who I think perhaps knows what he's doing more than he lets on. And that's quite easy, therefore, for opponents to not really be able to get a grip on, and someone who can be quite slippery and hard to take on face to face. So I think in that sense, there are some really important political parallels, even if biologically a self-made millionaire or semi-self-made millionaire from Queens and a boarding school boy from Eton who went to Oxford, a very traditional background in that sense, kind of belies the fact that they are quite similar, certainly in their style of politics.
You are listening to Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Doug Becker. We are discussing Brexit in light of Boris Johnson's assumption to the prime minister position with Paul Craig of the University of Oxford, Russell Foster of King's College London, and Simon Radford, an independent scholar based in the United Kingdom.
I know with Boris Johnson, I'm also reminded, historians are quick to point out that the American president, Dwight Eisenhower, used to purposely mangle some of his words, his syntax, because he thought that made him seem more down home. And at the time, he was described as perhaps not being intellectually up to the task of being president. Looking back, I'm always shocked at that, because if he's intellectually up to the task of holding together a coalition to win the Second World War, I can't imagine the White House was beyond his grasp. But that Johnson has been described in the same way, that he will purposely go on bizarre tangents or make arguments that seem to suggest that he isn't intellectually up to the task. But I've heard from numerous scholars, from numerous, analysts, that that's one of the great miscalculations, that when he does that, he knows exactly what he's doing to try to appeal to the common voter. Would you agree?
I think there's a bit of an irony, too, in that while he seems to be bumbling in physical affect, I mean, famously, if you Google Boris Johnson and zipline, you get some quite funny pictures of him stuck on a zipline, looking rather helmless with a hard hat on. He also has a kind of whimsical use of Latin, which he throws in every now and again, and in a way that I guess one can only really say when describing British politics rather than any other country. But he does that because it makes him stand out. And there's, I think this word authenticity gets used a lot without being really problematized. But there's something about how Donald Trump communicates kind of staccato style in simple words, in a way that everyone can understand, in a way that conveys an emotionality, and that derives a certain authenticity, and it's unlike how anyone else communicates and is very memorable. It kind of cuts through the noise in a world where we're constantly berated, kind of barraged by images. So too, Boris Johnson's slightly mad, Latin-affected prose and slightly irregular visual imagery, I think, cuts through the noise and conveys a certain difference to politicians, frankly, who all too often seem quite indistinguishable from one another. I think if you look at Ed Miliband versus David Cameron, I think probably if you came down from Mars and you didn't know anything about the two of them, you could quite easily get them confused in some ways, as people, as appearances. They both went to Oxford. They both came from quite political families and studied the same course at the same university. I think that's, in terms of Boris Johnson and Donald Trump, that you would pick them out on the lineup of politicians as being quite different from one another.
If you could imagine what Great Britain is going to look like, say, in the year 2024, 5 years from now, with its relationship with Europe, with social issues that have been raised, and political leadership, what do you imagine the nation, will look like in 5 years as a result of this process of Brexit? And I guess one obvious question is, will we still be talking about Brexit and wondering if we're finally going to hit the deadline, or will it keep getting pushed back by then? But I'm imagining something will have happened. There'll be some sort of resolution to this. So I'll start with Paul Craig.
Predictions are never easy, but you've asked the question. So assuming that we've left, and I think certainly by 2024, it would have been resolved one way or the other. So assuming that we have left, and we have left without a deal. I think that the situation in 2024 will be one in which we are economically poorer, probably already by something approximating to somewhere between 8 to 12% of GDP. Very difficult to work out exactly how much. Depends how many CEOs of companies decide to relocate, etc. Depends on hit on inward investment, but there will be a significant hit. But I think, so that bit, I think, is reasonably obvious. But actually, I think the bits which are less obvious are equally interesting. And I think there are two other dimensions which are equally interesting. One is that I think we will have a skills shortage. And I think that notwithstanding all the rather regrettable and embarrassing anti-EU immigrant rhetoric which came out from the UK, both from voters and from politicians, I think what you will find is that we will have a skill shortage, because actually, again, one of the paradoxes and one of the terrible tragedies of that dimension of the Brexit debate is that everything that has been said about voter reaction to EU immigrants, everything's been said about the perception, is correct. But the reality is almost entirely otherwise. So studies, all the detailed studies which have been done have shown that the UK has got in the past a net benefit from EU, a net economic benefit from EU migration of somewhere in the region of 20 billion. And even from the newer accession member states, the East European countries, a net economic benefit of about 5 to 6 GDP, billion GDP. And the idea that these people have come across and have been welfare scroungers and all that sort of thing, and again, there's no empirical foundation for it. All the studies which have been done basically show that these people are less likely to make claims on our welfare services than our native British people. Now, that doesn't mean there hasn't been an immigration problem. There has, because the spread of immigration is not even across the whole of the UK. And there have been problems in particular towns or areas where there's been a disproportionate number of EU immigrants, and that has not been handled well politically. But in any event, just keeping focused on the question, I think there will be a drop off of EU migration. People will not come, they will not feel secure, they will not feel welcome. And those people brought skills. At one end of the economic scale, they brought skills which complemented those in the UK. At the other end of the economic scale, they were doing jobs that UK people didn't want to do. So I think in 2024, the second element is that we'll miss the people that we have shunned in the referendum. The third element in which will be evident in 2024, again, less obvious, but equally important. Much of the Leave campaign was sold on, let's bring back sovereignty to the UK, let's gain or regain sovereign autonomy over our own laws. If you look at what our laws will look like in 2024, they will not look very different from what they are now. The reason being that even if we are outside the UK, the EU, with a hard Brexit, there will be a plethora of direct and indirect reasons why we continue to track EU law. So the idea that we are going to suddenly recreate or create a whole set of regulatory provisions which are completely different from those which we're presently bound by is simply nonsense. And putting it in, as it were, very down-to-earth terms, if you are making washing machines in Birmingham and you want to sell them into the EU, you are going to have to comply with EU rules anyway, whether within the EU or not. So if the UK want to impose a double regulatory burden on you by having the EU regulatory burden and a separate UK regulatory burden, of course, the UK Parliament could do that. But that really would be cutting off your nose to spite your face. So there will be many, many areas where the status quo now will be replicated in 2024.
I'm going to let Paul Craig have the last word there. We certainly will continue watching the story, looking forward to these developments, and certainly looking forward to October 31st, which I'd like to end with a notation that perhaps it's fitting that the date that they've chosen for the Brexit to actually happen is Halloween. Thank you very much.
Paul Craig is currently professor of English law at the University of Oxford and a fellow of St. John's College. He is the author of Britain Alone, The Implications and Consequences of United Kingdom Exit from the EU. Russell Foster is an early career fellow at the Department of European and International Studies at King's College London. He is author of Cry God for Harry, England, and St. George, Europe, and the Limits of Integrating Identity. And Simon Radford is an independent scholar based in the United Kingdom. He is co-author of Can Donations Buy You a British Peerage? A Study in the Link Between Party, Political Funding, and Peerage Nominations, 2005 to 2014.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.